There's no shortage of critics in today's world. Make an unpopular decision, and your opponents are throwing darts at you before you can finish a sentence. Well, if you're growing weary of harsh criticism, you're not alone. And today, on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll offers 7 timeless principles for handling criticism with grace and grit. His application is drawn from the life of Paul, who modeled how to put on spiritual armor when the arrows of accusation are headed your way. Chuck titled today's message, Dealing with Critics as Paul Did.
The Apostle Paul, while in the process of writing letters to churches and founding churches and mentoring the younger men who were to follow in his steps, he came back home and he got to Jerusalem, and there was no ticker tape parade. There was no applause. No church opened the doors to say, "Welcome back, you hero. You have been our model while you've been gone." There was none of that. There was, in fact, a group of people who had followed him like a bad dog. They're called simply the Jews from Asia. They didn't even live in Jerusalem. But these Jews from Asia were determined to make life miserable for him. So he goes on defense. The first defense begins in chapter 22, where he speaks Aramaic to them, verses 1 to 21, speaking to them about the truth. They're standing there trying to decide what they really believe. When he gets to the subject of the Gentiles, he uses the G word, verse 21, they turn back to their riot. How dare he even mention that blasted name in their midst? And that defense then stops, and he is taken by a commander from the Romans who is named Lysias. And Lysias brings him ultimately to the Jews' Supreme Court, called the Sanhedrin, translated verse 30, the council. Chapter 22, verse 30, he stood before all the council, and Paul was brought down and he addressed them. And while he is there, a plot is formed against him, a conspiracy. But before the conspiracy, look at 23:11. And if you don't have a red letter Bible, you won't see these words stand out. But if you do, you'll see them in red. On the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, and now it's in red, "Take courage. For as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also." Who was in Rome? Why? The ruler of the world. The Roman emperor, Nero, sat on his throne in Rome. And the Lord is saying to him, "Paul, you've stood for me in the streets. You've been out in the wilds, and you have been on the sea, and you have been before riots, and you have been mistreated by those who had no reason to lay hands on you. You have witnessed for me faithfully, Paul. You're going to Rome, and you're going to speak for me there." You can almost hear his heart pounding in his chest at that point. This was great. But while that's going on, there's a conspiracy being planned against him. You remember this. Over 40, verse 13, formed this plot. And they placed themselves under oath, verse 12, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. How's that for a study in contrast? Here's Paul waiting in his cell for the Lord to open a door, and the Lord speaks and says, "You're going to represent me in Rome." At the same time, we've got these clods outside with their heads together making plans to kill him. And they're not going to eat and drink until the plot is fulfilled. That's pretty quick. As soon as he gets into the streets, we're going to jump him, and the ambush will be complete. Now, what's interesting is the serendipity that occurs. Verse 16, out of the blue, out of the blue, first and only time any personal family reference of anyone related to Paul is mentioned, and it's his sister's son, his nephew. I mean, nephews are not famous usually. They're just nephews. And here is one. He isn't even named, but you know what? In God's plan, he is the secret of Paul's survival. He's out back playing ping pong or something, and he listens over the wall, and he hears a group of guys, or to even be more serious about it, maybe he was one of them and couldn't stand it. Maybe he was one of them. But the point is, he came to Paul and he says, "You've got to know something. They're out to get you, and they're going to kill you." An ambush is planned. Paul says, "Shh, stop." Calls a centurion. The centurion takes him to Lysias. Remember our friend Lysias? The commander listens, and he tells him in verses 20 and 21, the Jews have agreed that as soon as you bring him down to the council tomorrow, they're going to ambush and kill him. Well, Lysias sort of overreacts. He pulls together not 10 or 12 or 15, count them, 472 Romans, some on horseback, some with spears. They get a mount for Paul to ride. Remember this, and you saw it last time, and Paul goes 40 miles down to Caesarea by the sea, leaving at night and getting there probably early morning by horseback surrounded by the soldiers. Perfect. I had several people say to me after the last message, "Did these guys ever eat and drink as a result?" I don't know. It always drives me nuts when I'm asked questions that I don't have a clue to the answer. And so that's one of them. And obviously they did eat and drink. You know how those terrorists are. They just keep on going, lying through their lips. And Paul is safe in Caesarea, but he's not free of the critic. The critic went along with him. And now he sits before a man named Felix. We know Felix as a cartoon character. We don't know anybody named Felix. Doesn't sound very significant to be sitting before Felix. What you don't know is that he's Pontius Pilate's successor. Pilate has died. He ministered as governor, procurator while Jesus was on trial. He's since left, and as of AD 52, Felix has taken his place. He's a sorry piece of humanity, even though he is in a place of political significance. And after 5 days, the critics are after Paul. Look at verse 1, chapter 24. This is where it gets really interesting. And I want to share with you 7 ways Paul handled criticism, and I want you to write them down. They're not that difficult, and they'll be useful for you when your face is on someone's dartboard. And it's your turn next. 24:1. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders with an attorney named Tertullus. Tertullus. See, when I come across names like this, I am intrigued. And I think, I wonder what he looked like. He a fat little dumpy guy that walked around in a toga? Or was he maybe a 6'3" and handsome and dark? And did he look like Fast Eddie, who hangs out behind the scenes, you know? Did he do the dirty work of crooks? What's this Tertullus like? And my sources helped me. You will read with me, after Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, "Since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this whole nation." It's called smoke blowing in Texas. "We acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. But that I may not weary you any further, I beg you to grant us by your kindness a brief hearing." Now, let me tell you about Felix and a little bit about Tertullus. John Pollock writes very well about these guys. "Tertullus knew perfectly well that since the appointment of Felix In AD 52, Judea had suffered widespread bloodshed. And from the increase in political murders after he had arranged for the ex-high priest, Jonathan, to be assassinated in the temple itself. Felix's greed was notorious. He had been born a slave, had risen to power on the shoulders of his brother Pallas, a favorite of Claudius. And his character is well summed up by Tacitus. He exercised the power of a king with the mind of a slave. The guy's a crook. He's a crook. And by hook and crook, he got to the position he's in, corrupt to the core. He goes on, Tertullus puffed out his cheeks and hitched his robe in the immemorial manner of advocates with weak cases. Isn't that who stated well? He walks up to the scene and sort of puffs his cheeks and pours out all his smoke, and the whole thing's a sham. You know what I'm amazed by? Paul, who stands there, who really has the case, stands and listens to this nonsense. As Tertullus pours out this garbage in front of Felix and adds, we have found this man a real pest, verse 5, and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. Does that seem a little exaggerated? I mean, throughout the world? Wrong. And a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. The word sect could be rendered heresies of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to desecrate the temple, and then we arrested him. We wanted to judge him according to our own law, but Lysias, the commander, came along and with much violence took him out of our hand. A man's talking about violence, and he's the one who's been the ringleader of violence. And by the way, Lysias never used violence. He simply protected Paul in the only way that he could have. Felix is listening to all of this, and Pollock adds, Paul, on the other hand, showed himself entirely at ease, able to offer appropriate courtesies without flattery and to argue with a legal skill which had not withered in the long years since he had practiced. And Paul steps up. His words are brief and to the point, and this begins the first of seven ways he handled criticism. Let me give you the first one. He refused to be caught up in the emotion of the charges. Write that down. That's the first mistake we usually make. He refused to be caught up in the emotion of the charges. Paul begins verse 10, knowing that for many years you have been judge to this nation. That was true. I cheerfully make my defense. Cheerfully. Cheerfully. That word is in the Greek text. I am pleased to make my defense. By now, the guy ought to be mad as a hatter. All the things that they've done against him. And he says, I am pleased to have this opportunity to make my defense. You know how he could do it? He didn't get caught up in the emotion of the charges. Chances are good when we are criticized, we pick up the emotion of the one criticizing us. And we become sometimes more angry than the one who's criticized us. At that point, straight thinking goes out the window, and we begin to get lost in the morass of defending ourselves and closing our minds to a wise approach to what might be used or said. Paul doesn't go there. He says, I cheerfully make my defense. Since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship. The second thing he does, he stayed with the facts. He stayed with the facts. He said, you can check my record. 12 days ago, I went up to worship. You can ask those who were there. Neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. He's just spelling out the facts. 1, 2, 3, he stayed with the facts, verses 11 and 12. Here's the third. He told the truth with a clear conscience, verses 13 to 16. nor can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way, now watch closely. It is true, Governor Felix, it is true that I'm a follower of the way. According to the way, which they call a heresy, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the laws and that which is written in the prophets. Same laws and prophets they believe in, I uphold and believe in. Having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, and that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. We would agree on that as Pharisees. And he even adds, in view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience before both before God and before men. There is nothing like a clear conscience. You sleep so well. You think so clearly. You have no fear that some skeleton will rattle when the investigation begins, because there is no skeleton to rattle. And operating from a clear conscience, he tells the truth. May I pause for a moment and just drive home a very practical point? If you are somewhere in some kind of defense of yourself, and some of you are, I'm sure, don't get anywhere near a falsehood. And if you have already, go back and correct it. Admit it. Why would I say that? Because as soon as you step into a lie, you weaken your case and you will never be free. It's the truth that sets us free. I have used that same plan in rearing our family. I have used that same plan in keeping a marriage together. I've used the same plan in every time I've had occasion to counsel. What is the truth? What is the right thing to say? Well, it's so-and-so, but you know, it's pretty painful. No, what's the right thing to say? Well, it's so-and-so. Say that. Say that. Well, she won't believe. Say that. Don't say something that will help her like to hear it. Say that. Don't say what he is waiting to hear or hopes you say. Say the truth. That's exactly what Paul does. In view of this, I always do my best to maintain a blameless conscience before God and before man. Told the truth with a clear conscience. Beginning at verse 17 down through 19, don't miss this one, number 4, he identified the original source of the criticism. He identified the original source of the criticism. Verse 17, now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified without any crowd or uproar, but there were some Jews from Asia. I would say that is identifying the original source. There were the Jews from Asia who ought to have been present before you and to make accusation if they should have anything against me, and he is right as rain. Where are they? I have Tertullus, I have the high priest, I have a group of people who are here as so-called witnesses. Where are my original critics? I want to say there are a few things more maddening than shadow boxing when you're dealing with criticism. One of the worst things you can do when you're working in a situation that is critical is to spread the venom to a number of other people, your children or your parents, or a set of friends, or a group of other Christians, rather than going to the original point of contention and staying there. You've got to be a man to do that. You've got to be a real woman to do that. Paul is man enough to say, I know it's the Jews from Asia. Where are they? It only complicates when you bring others into the setting and then shape their opinions based on what you have to say about this situation. And of course, the reputation becomes increasingly more soiled, and the morale is demoralized. The whole spirit of the thing gets sideways. And of course, someone's authority gets undermined. I don't know where you are in any of this story. Obviously, this is a first century setting removed from your particular situation. But I want to say, if any of you are in the process of casting stones, throw them just at the one who's the target. And be man enough to say, I threw that stone. Or put your stones back in your pocket and walk away. There's so much more I could say on that. I have rarely been hurt the most by the original source, unless you say, well, look at what they stirred up. They did stir up, but my pain has come mainly from second, third, fourth hand sources who just believe hearsay, and they don't even know what they're talking about. So he identifies the source. Fifth, he would not surrender and quit. I love that about Paul. He's like a bulldog on your ankle. He will not let go. I love that about him. I love that about Israel. They will not let go of what they know is right. When you travel over there, you see it. You see it. There's such courage in Paul. He says, they ought to have been present before you, or else let these men themselves tell what misdeed they found when I stood before the council. Name what I did wrong. And now, the reason I say he wouldn't surrender or quit is because I'm thinking back. This is implied over the other trials. He had been beaten, and he didn't give up. He got right back up again. He had been accused. He stands firm in the truth. He had been followed. He didn't run from them. He has been knocked down, and the man will not give up.
Beaten, accused, knocked down. Paul refused to give up. And there's a lot more to this story that Chuck Swindoll will share with us. He titled today's message, Dealing with Critics as Paul Did. You're listening to Insight for Living, and we've set aside time to hear some personal comments from Chuck in just a moment. But first, I want to tell you about a beautiful tabletop resource called Guided by Grace. You may have received a copy at your home. It's an exclusive resource from our creative team here at Insight for Living. And if you haven't received a copy, let us know. We'll make sure it's sent to you right away. You can request your copy at insight.org/grace. Our friends often ask us about Insight for Living's plans for the future and our vision to make disciples in all 195 countries of the world. After 46 years of God's faithfulness to this ministry, we have absolute confidence that His grace will guide us into the future. The resource I mentioned includes clarifying statements from our president, Carissa Swindoll Gaither, behind-the-scenes pictures at the ministry's headquarters, and stunning visuals that clearly illustrate the impact of your personal investment in Insight for Living. So contact us today and ask for the tabletop resource called Guided by Grace. You can reach us at 800-772-8888 or find it online at insight.org/grace. Now, here's Chuck.
It may be hard for you to believe it, but we've been doing this together for 46 years. We go all the way back to 1979. Some of you may have been listening for 3-4 years, others 5, 10, maybe 30 or more years. But all through these days and weeks and years, it has been my joyful privilege to open the truths of God's Word and share those truths with you. What a joy, what a privilege, what an honor has been mine. The other day I had someone ask me if I had a favorite virtue, one of God's character traits that was a standout to me more than any other. Didn't take me long to answer, oh, that's rather easy for me to say, grace. Grace, grace, God's grace, the grace to handle pain, the grace to grow in the knowledge of His Word, the grace to love others who are sometimes unlovely, the grace to forgive those who hurt us. All of that has been a part of our ministry, and I've emphasized grace regularly from one year to the next. So thankful for this opportunity. So grateful for you, and I mean that, for without you, I'd be talking to four walls, and that wouldn't help anybody. But because you're there, and so many others just like you, and many others who are not like you at all, who are often hurting, troubled, seeking information, struggling, whatever may be the situation, it's amazing how over the years God's word has been opened and they found hope to go on, grace to endure, peace with God, which comes only through His Son, Jesus Christ. As we reach the end of this fiscal year for our ministry, I want to urge you to think about what the ministry has meant to you and also remember what it can mean to others as they turn to this source of treasure and truth. And then I would ask you to give and to give generously, that we might continue doing what we've been doing these 46 years, and we'll move right on into the next year with the same enthusiasm, the same joy as before. Now, you see, you play a vital part in this, not only as our listener, as our friend, our sister, but as our faithful support. See, all of the things I've named happen because there are financial provisions made for us to afford them. Airtime is costly, and going to other countries is costly, and financing the ministry of those who represent us in other languages is costly. And your gift helps make all of this happen. I cannot tell you how important it is or how grateful I am for it. I'm not going anywhere. I'm coming to you, and I'll be coming to you day after day as I've done all through these years. Thank you for what you're able to give to the ministry of Insight for Living. And I thank you with my whole heart.
To respond to Chuck Swindoll, there are several easy ways to give a donation. Many prefer to send a check in the mail. If that's you, address your envelope to Insight for Living, Post Office Box 5000, Frisco, Texas 75034. To speak with one of our friendly ministry reps, call us at 800-772-8888. That's 800-772-8888. And you can give a donation online at insight.org/donate. Are you growing weary of harsh criticism? I'm Bill Meyer. Chuck Swindoll presents Timeless Wisdom on Handling Criticism with Grace, Tuesday on Insight for Living. The preceding message, Dealing with Critics as Paul Did, was copyrighted in 2001, 2003, and 2024, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2024 by Charles R. Swindoll, Incorporated. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.